Good.
Okay, welcome to our second installment of the series for business owners. We do a series of workshops for business owners, and this series of workshops is for really anybody that's wanting to monetize their business and either sell it at some point or create liquidity along the way. And they're led by a pretty good brain trust that over the years has helped thousands of business owners. We've got the president of IBA on with us, Gregory Kosky. IBA is a firm that has completed well over 4,000 business transactions, and it's the oldest business brokerage firm in the Northwest. So thanks, Gregory, for joining. How are you doing this afternoon?
I'm very good, getting into the holiday spirit.
Yeah, good, good. And then Wade Stringfield, who's a SBA specialist at Savvy Bank. Thanks for joining, Gregory and Wade.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, and myself, my name is Aaron Scannell. I'm the CEO of Heritage Wealth. We were the Forbes number two ranked wealth management firm in Washington this past year. And for these workshops, each of our firms, we essentially just draw from a bunch of experience in working with business owners, and we've drawn from thousands of cases. Part one of this particular series was last month, and we covered essentially what's my business worth and how do I maximize its value. And today we're talking about the thing that a lot of business owners don't spend a lot of time thinking about until they exit, which is what is next and having a plan ready for the exit. And this is important because a lot of business owners do have regrets about their exit. So we'll talk about the main source of some of those regrets and what actual business owners have said they do differently in order to avoid having the regrets, and I think you'll find the answer to it pretty simple and straightforward and easy to implement. And then we'll also cover tax strategies for upon an exit, how to keep the taxes as low as possible. We do see just a massive variance in terms of what different sellers pay in taxes, sometimes in the same industry, sometimes in the same type of business. And it's just a wide variance of tax rates that people pay, all the way down to 0%. So we'll share some specific and tangible techniques used by legal and tax teams to reduce what certain sellers pay that have planned this in advance. So we'll get into a couple things like Section 1202, qualified small business stock, and that gives sellers the potential, some sellers, the potential to exempt $10 million of their sale from tax altogether, 0% tax rate on that, up to $10 million. And then we'll also cover code 453A, and that one doesn't even have a limit to it. You could have $100 million in a business sale and be able to defer the tax for up to 30 years. And then we'll talk about opportunity zones and ESOPs and dynasty trusts, and there's a bunch of good stuff. So maybe not the most holiday-related topic, but when there's potential to save hundreds of thousands or millions in tax, this ends up being, at least from our regard, very motivating. So let's talk about the regrets first, the common regrets. And you might have seen some of these articles that get written quite a bit about, like they'll title them the top regrets of the dying. Not business owners, but just people when they're end of life. There are palliative nurses out there who have worked with thousands of dying patients over their careers, and they've surveyed them and just asked them, what do you most appreciate about your life? And then what do you regret? And they've done some of these studies also when people go into retirement, and they've done them even more narrowly for business owners when they sell their business, when they sell their baby. And a lot of the data is showing that even the most affluent and successful founders struggle with a common problem, which is the regret of how they handled leaving their company. So they don't necessarily regret leaving the company. They regret how they did it. And that's what we'll talk a little bit more about today is are you ready for what should be the happiest day of your life? And the four major drivers of an exit without regret are, and they're on the visual here, but it's the future vision. What do you plan to go do after you leave your business? It has to do with personal detachment. Have you built a fulfilling life outside your company? also has to do with structuring flexibility and also team involvement, so making sure employees are treated well upon the exit. And the bottom line of a lot of this research and in our own experiences and working with a lot of business owners is that for business owners that don't have regrets, there's one thing they did differently that had far more influence than anything else in terms of them being happy with the outcome. It was just one thing, and it was that they had an intentional succession plan. And I don't mean the business plan itself. That's the plan for running the business, growing the business. And I don't even mean the document that lays out what happens when the business is sold and to whom. That's part of the succession plan, but it's only one component of it. So, Gregory, Wade, what else would you share about what, in your guys' experiences, have helped the business owners that you've worked with that are happy with the outcome get to that happy spot?
Well, I think the key, and you illustrated this, is to give an entrepreneur a comprehensive roadmap on what is ahead. And it's often starting before you even leave the garage on the journey. It's understanding how businesses are valued. So if you understand how they're valued, you can decide when you want to bring that car out of the garage, detail it, and put it up for market. It may not be ready to go to market for a year or two. It's understanding, now that you know the market value, what is your net after taxes? Because the tax implications may force you to adjust timing. It's knowing how to structure the transition, how to deal with employees, key customers, suppliers, all the elements of transitioning ownership. And one thing we tried very hard at IBA to do is paint the whole picture. Let them step back and see what it looks like. And knowing that for us, the sale process takes 3 to 9 months. So it's not an impulse sale. It's not going to happen overnight. But if you know where the turns in the road are, where the potholes are, before you get there, I think it's very beneficial. And Aaron, you can comment in that knowing what you're netting after taxes is one step, but then what can you do with that asset as part of your estate plan, legacy plan, once you get that bag of gold?
Yep, for sure. I think that's well said. And it's creating, for a lot of business owners, it's figuring out how to turn an asset into an income stream that is passive, that you don't necessarily have to work in and manage and run on a day-to-day basis. And that's a big transition for business owners. But also, when it's done right, it is so freeing. Yeah. It is so freeing. Wade, anything else you'd share here, or should we?
You know what? I wholeheartedly agree with both you guys, and I would just say start early. You know, that's the thing that when I look back at some of the happiest sellers, you know, Gregory mentioned how long the actual process might take, but the idea of putting this plan together, you know, developing a future vision for the seller, you know, the happiest sellers that I know are ones that were moving to another role, if you will, right? They had something in mind post-sale. It wasn't just like the sale and then that's it. So, and I think that takes some time to develop even before you, you know, get on the 6 to 9 month road.
Yeah, exactly, because the business ends up, for a lot of us as founders and entrepreneurs, it ends up being a big part of our identity. So to not just leave that gaping hole once yeah. it's sold is important. And Gregory, you shared some of the things that go into a good succession plan. And what we're finding and learning from business owners is we just gotta be prepared, because only 3 in 10 have a written succession plan, even though 7 in 10 have thought about a succession plan. So 70% of us have thought about it, only 30% of us have actually written a succession plan. And that statistic is actually pretty similar when it comes to general planning, like planning someone's finances. That statistic's a little more bifurcated, where over 90% of people believe they should have a financial plan, and only 20% have actually created a formal written plan. And it just, I think, for most people, it makes intuitive sense that we'd have a plan, but I think it's just easy to put off for another day. Do you guys have any ideas or suggestions for, like, getting over that inertia to just create it?
Well, in a family business, I would say the other element is don't do your succession plan in a vacuum. If you want to transition the business to your daughter or son, make sure they want the helm of the ship. I have seen many times where a child enjoys being in the business because it's quality time working with their parent, but they don't want all the responsibilities that go with being the president. There are other ones who are chomping at the bit for the old man to retire and allow them to take over. Yep. But I think whether it's your spouse, your business partner, your kids, it's important to have those discussions and listen to what the different parties want. Don't think that, you know, you move all the chess pieces, because when it comes to people's lives, people have lots of different motivations and goals in life, and many of them are not financial. And what you think should motivate someone often does not.
Yep, we're seeing that spot on. And that's an encouragement from our end is discussions around things like this, especially with family members, can be tricky, and double especially when money's involved or business is involved. Those are hard discussions. We end up facilitating a lot of those discussions, whether it's between a parent and a kid around a business, or a partner and a partner when there's partners in the business, multiple owners in the business. And those end up, they can end up, if done in the right way, they can end up in a really healthy spot. Those conversations can. And a lot of times it's just people getting stuff off their chest that they've held in and bottled up for a long time. Now let's do a quick definition of what a really good succession plan would look like versus, again, what I think a lot of people have in their mind as a succession plan is just, you know, I get a document together, a contract together that provides a buy-sell agreement. But it goes beyond that. So succession planning can involve, and really should involve, a strategy for passing on the leadership roles, the ownership of a company to an employee, group of employees, or an outsider, family member. But it ensures, the whole point is to ensure the business continues to run smoothly after a company's most important people move on to new opportunities, or they retire, pass away. And anyway, we'll talk about how to create a good succession plan, whether the successor is internal or an external buyer. But it really could involve a clear picture in financials of the current state, a formal valuation. This is where IBA can be really helpful. Estate planning, essentially what happens if you die before you've sold it. Contingency planning, so what happens if you get sued, or if you got disabled or lost a key person, say a partner or just a key employee on the team. And then it really has got to involve the execution of the sale and wealth management for the proceeds, and turning the proceeds into passive income streams, or getting it ready for investment in the next business, because a lot of business, you know, entrepreneurs, we end up being serial entrepreneurs and we go start multiple things. Right, it becomes a little bit of an addiction. But it's all got to be centered in your personal goals, whether it be to retire, use the proceeds for another venture, and then it's got to involve funding mechanisms. Essentially, the techniques that you would use to help employees buy the business who otherwise wouldn't have the money to purchase the business, or whether it involves financing through, you know, through someone like Wade and Keyman and BuySells and ESOPs. And I'm probably going into too much of a list there, but what else would you guys share as far as important components to a really good succession plan?
You know, you've got, maybe this is an unfortunate set of circumstances, because I would tell you if people came in with even three of these, you know, already on paper, I would be shocked, at least in my line of work. You know, you're typically very narrow focus on that final transaction piece. Probably the best planning I've ever observed was when a husband and wife owner were going to sell to an ESOP, and that elicited a lot of questions about roles, responsibilities, what happens, this and that, and that was probably the most in-depth planning I've seen. But you know, most people aren't getting this in depth, at least in the arena of financing that I'm typically in, and I can see the value in it, and hopefully other people will start seeing that as well.
I would say a component on the contingency planning is insurance planning, and it can be a life insurance policy for the primary owner. It could be life insurance plans for partners. It could be life insurance for key employees. We've seen what's happened recently with the tornadoes. It can be business interruption insurance and planning for that 1 in 1,000 situation. Planning for those sort of things, to me, is good entrepreneurship. You want to be forward thinking and sales and profits and growing the company, but you do got to mitigate risk. And I think it's important that you don't ignore the actual table elements that are going to happen to some businesses. May not happen to yours, but I don't know if you've been following the candle factory and that was destroyed by the tornadoes, but you know, they were working up until it came through. I mean, they never planned on that.
Yeah, well said. And I think that's a good segue into that risk discussion, because if we zero in on that, that ends up, we find, providing a disproportionate amount of confidence and peace of mind to the person planning around that, the business owner, compared to the effort that they have to put forth to get some of those protections in place. So that it's like protecting against risk and getting your ducks in a row, as they say. If you're like a lot of business owners, your business is your biggest asset, and it's just good to get things in place so your business income is protected as well as the asset of the business itself. And one of the biggest risks to a business is liability risk. So say a lawsuit, you know, we're in the most litigious society in the world, and there's no shortage of attorneys looking for people with assets to make a claim against. I know a few of them personally, and that's a risk in particular for business owners. Just that subject of asset protection, liability protection, and getting safeguards in place to insulate your personal assets from claims against the business and vice versa. And some of the techniques used in asset protection planning also can involve and solve for succession planning. So things like LLCs, limited liability companies, where they can help to protect your assets from the claims that could be made against your business, or real estate too. They can limit liability, but LLCs are not fail-proof. And you might have heard of foreclosure of LLC orders, and that's where judges have the ability to dissolve the protections of an LLC in certain cases. So it's just good to look at that, as well as, you know, there's judicial dissolutions, there's charging orders, And that's where the type of entity can have a big impact. So whether it's an LLC you're using to protect versus an S-corp or a C-corp or a partnership, as well as the other thing it emphasizes is even just the location of the LLC. And that might sound weird. Like if your business is in Washington, you'd think, well, I got to set up my LLC in Washington, and not necessarily. So that's important where we see so many business owners shortchange that planning. So they just pick an entity and go. They move quick, and moving quick is often good for business owners. But when choosing an entity, it often results in a lot more liability than people need. Anything come to mind for you guys? Any experiences you guys have had with liability protection and some of the strategies used for better protecting the business and personal assets?
It's pretty routine in my line of work, definitely, to see, buyers especially, and some sellers in some cases, but definitely buyers when they're getting into it, to have a couple entities, depending on the asset, nature of the assets. My favorite story regarding this kind of, protection from liability is from an accountant that told me once that, you could even do all the right things. You could be in the right entity, you can establish something, but if the actual owner doesn't operate it like an actual entity, meaning having annual meetings or meetings of some kind, having meeting minutes, establishing roles, responsibilities, judges can come in and say, well, you've operated this thing like it was a sole proprietor, and so now we're gonna treat it as such. So you lose the protections that way as well. So I've always remembered that. I always try to pass that on, but I do leave the actual decision of what entity up to, an attorney or a CPA.
No, it's very smart to think through the protections. One strategy to mitigate liability that I like is if you've been a tenant for a long time, try to drop the personal guarantee on the lease before you go to market, because if you have a personal guarantee, a landlord may keep you on as a guarantor on that lease, but if you've worked ahead of the curve and dropped that guarantee, they can't go back to you for a personal guarantee if it doesn't exist in the lease.
Yep, good point. And the last thing I'd mention here is just around the location of the entity. Again, a lot of business owners shortchange that aspect of it, but think outside of the state, whatever state you're in, just think outside of the state for where you could set the entity up. So like Delaware, Nevada, Wyoming are a few places to at least think about. And if you just use Delaware as an example, more than 60% of Fortune 500 companies are incorporated in Delaware. So they're not all headquartered there, certainly. But why would 60% of the, quote, smart people out there go set up their corporations in Delaware? And it's because of corporate involvement, where Delaware tends to just be more legally predictable. So there's been more settlements there of mergers and acquisitions and shareholder disputes, and it's created a bunch of case law that goes back more than 100 years. And it's created a lot of precedent-setting information on what you can and can't do, and really some of the benefits have to do with additional protections for the owner of businesses. So companies don't just set up their businesses there, their LLC there, for the history of the case law. They set it up because it's more predictable that they can protect themselves with way higher certainty than in other states. And so that's not a commercial for setting it up in Delaware. It's just an example of some states are way safer when setting up an entity than other states. So it's an important conversation to have with your tax, legal, and wealth management team. And as we mentioned earlier, part one of this workshop was, and I think Gregory and Wade, you did a really good job just sharing factors for driving higher valuations when you do sell, and factors beyond just the price that should be negotiated. If you didn't hear that one, we've got a podcast for that too, so let us know if you want to hear that one. But as I mentioned earlier today, the business owners that are happiest coming out of a sale have also come out strong from a tax standpoint. So Gregory mentioned it earlier. It's like how much money you get is important in the sale. How much money you get to keep after taxes is arguably quite a bit more important, because that can, it can vary so much. So we'll get into specific and tangible techniques for reducing your tax. That's what we'll do now. And actually, first things first, this subject is so important because, and I want to emphasize this, it can seem obvious that tax planning is important, but so few people do it ahead of the time. They use an accountant, but the accountant, the CPA is dominated by doing tax returns, which is a very in-the-moment process, and sometimes rear-view mirror, where they're doing all their work in April for the year that has already passed. And what we're talking about is doing proactive planning for next year, 2 years out, 3 years out, 5 years out, because you have way more control about it. And that's why I just wanted to emphasize the importance of this, because, you know, Tax Freedom Day, if you've heard of that, have you guys heard of that term before, Gregory or Wade?
Yeah, I like that term.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of depressing, too. But it's the day of the year when we've earned enough money to pay our total taxes for that year. So kind of like how they talk about Black Friday. That's the first day of the year retail stores actually have made money. You know, the first 11 months of the year have gone into just paying all the expenses of the business. Then everything they're on is profit. Well, Tax Freedom Day is similar. You don't have to wait till November for it. But it's different in every state because state taxes vary. Now, for business owners, Tax Freedom Day is April 19th in Washington State. In Oregon, it's April 17th, similar. In California, it's a little later, April 23rd. And so it takes a while to earn enough money to pay all the taxes due for that year for the average American. And this always gets people riled up. But for people that plan ahead, Tax Freedom Day can be way earlier. So like Warren Buffett gets his Tax Freedom Day in late February. And we've got some clients who got to their Tax Freedom Day this year by mid-January. So they spent 2 weeks of the year earning the money they need to pay this year's taxes versus the average American who has to work over 3.5 months. So I just like that concept because it makes it more tangible. Otherwise, we're just in the day-to-day working and paying tax, and it just becomes automatic. And I find that people often take that defeatist mindset of, I'm just going to let taxes happen. That old Will Rogers quote of, there's nothing certain in life except for death and taxes. And yeah, taxes are a certainty, but you can get those taxes way lower. Gregory, I know you had talked about this article in our last workshop. Do you want to maybe make a few comments on this? This was a good article, I thought, in Forbes.
Yeah, it was an excellent. I may be taking a step back on taxes. I think a real-world example is beneficial. So the legislature in the state of Washington created a capital gains tax for our state. It would be a new tax. There are people who think it will be found unconstitutional. And I've been following that, and I tend to fall on that side of the ledger. But then there are very knowledgeable people who choose to use the assumption it's coming to be. And a great example is Satya, the head of Microsoft, who sold significant holdings in his shares of the company this year to take away the risk, the variable of the unknown. And that ties into risk acceptance from a tax standpoint. Taxes are often unknown, and We made it through 2021 without any significant tax changes on the federal government, but 22 is still unknown, and they can make changes up till December 31 that will impact us in 2022, and I'm saying December 31 of 2022. So you want to collect information, act based on available information, and get the best possible outcome. And so getting back to the Microsoft thing, and IBA has done about 30 million in transactions in the last 100 days. We have 14 transactions in escrow, pending sale as a firm. And all of those parties said, I want to take advantage of what exists today, and I'm going to bank my dollars and get out with good knowledge. So it ties into the article that, they took action. Otherwise, they'd go into 22 with some unknowns.
Yep.
Yeah, I'll just add, well said. I'll add that I've had one conversation with a business broker who said that, in talking with the seller, the seller did some math, and again, I'm not sure what math he did, but had come out with a number saying, well, I'm going to have to increase the purchase price of my business next year by X number of dollars in order to get the same return based on, this tax that everyone believes is coming around in the state of Washington anyway. So there's certainly people that are trying to do that, make those determinations and do the right thing or do the right thing for themselves. But it's a unique situation to be in. I'm surely hoping that if it does come into be and it stays, I hope that doesn't just immediately scare people off from buying and selling businesses, but I'm sure we'll adapt somehow.
Well, I don't think it, your analogy, I don't think the price can necessarily be increased. I believe with a business, it has a market value that experts can determine, and buyers, their CPAs, CFOs, bankers, investors, they will cross-check and verify. So what I think happens in that situation, if they need more net, it's not necessarily that we can adjust the price, because the price is the price, but you can adjust the timeline, almost in line with your tax freedom. Now someone who maybe was hoping to sell in 22 is going to say, because of what I'll lose in additional taxes, I will run the company for 22 and sell in 23.
Yep. That's exactly it. They were taking the extra time to build the value, more or less.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And there's a playbook, like a tax playbook, that can be used when and we use it when helping business owners, and it drives significant tax savings almost across the board. It involves two parts. Part one is strategies for lowering current year taxes before a sale. So it's like finding out ways to shelter more income through various tax shelters and benefits packages, and maximizing deductions and credits and exemptions and entity planning, so optimizing for the LLC versus S-Corp versus C-Corp. That's part one. And then part two is strategies for lowering taxes that could occur on the sale of the business, some of which lower taxes and some of which avoid taxes altogether. And that's what we'll cover now. So we'll start with the tax reduction strategies. And there's big savings in the current year planning. We do a workshop on this and have some resources we can share, but sometimes the bigger savings, as I mentioned earlier, they can come from looking ahead to a future sale of the business and structuring things to either reduce the tax on the sale or avoid it altogether. So that's what we're talking about today. So one of the things that can reduce tax on a sale is an installment sale. So if you defer the receipt of the purchase price of your business to later years with an installment sale, you might be able to postpone paying tax on your gains until you receive them. The downside, though, of that is you're taking risk that the buyer continues to make payments and you don't get all the proceeds up front, and tax rates are going up. So there's more momentum now than ever to raise taxes. So taxes are going up at some point. And so that's the danger with an installment sale. Now, the caveat to that is if you use code 453A and do an installment sale with a monetization loan, it's somewhat similar. Like, people have heard of 1031 exchanges, which allow you to defer taxes by exchanging one property for another. But those don't work for business sales, and they don't allow the seller to cash out. But very few, I can't remember the last client I talked with that had already had awareness of code 453A. That allows you to cash out on day one. So unlike a typical installment sale where you get money over time, you get all of your sales proceeds on day one. And you still, though, defer the taxes for up to 30 years. So again, different than a normal installment sale. So I always want to point that out every chance I can because people miss it all the time. And that works for all capital gain assets except for publicly traded stock. It works for art, works for real estate, works for private interests and businesses, and then businesses that are solely wholly owned by the owner. The other one, when we'll get into this in a minute, is intentional tax allocation is a strategy. And that has to do with how your business is treated for tax purposes in an eventual sale, whether it's taxed at capital gains or ordinary income. And we've got more information on that in a second on the next slide. But I'll do a quick mention of what Wade had alluded to in that story earlier around an ESOP. And that's a way to sell your company with deferral of tax or avoidance of tax altogether. So an ESOP is where you sell your company to the ESOP, and then the company buys the stock back. So the company gets a bank loan, or the owner can loan the company money if they wanted to, and then gives stock to the employees. And most owners only sell a portion of their business to an ESOP because they want a pile of cash and they maintain control over the business. But they can be pretty tax efficient to the owner. So I just wanted to mention those two. And then the last one on this page is tax shifting. And that's a strategy that's one of the most powerful in the tax code. And it's just the technique of shifting money to someone else in the family that is in a lower tax bracket. So it could be your kids, could be parents, which would be upstream gifting, kids would be downstream gifting. And it can provide, that whole exercise can be an amazing exercise itself in building a kid's financial skills, whether they're a minor or an adult. That process can be really helpful, we are finding.
So, yeah, I would add on the tax shifting, it also can be a strategy in the deal where maybe it's not family members, it's key employees.
Yep.
So I have seen where a small amount of stock is given to that person in a stock sale because it creates a golden handcuff and a ownership interest in the entity post-transaction. It's also a way a seller can reward long-term employees because then they don't have to pay taxes on those dollars because they didn't get the proceeds of the sale.
It's a great point. And Wade, I know you deal with this to some extent. Just, we were talking about that on the last slide, but the allocation of the price, the sales price, can be part of what governs the tax consequences. So it should be part of the plan. Anything you can share here?
Absolutely. It's just, you know, again, in my my world, you know, we're conscious of the SBA lending rules, and most banks will use an SBA loan program to finance a transaction like this where you're buying or selling a business. And you know, we can do either one with an SBA loan, whether it's a stock purchase or an asset purchase, is fine. But the allocation, you know, that is being purchased needs to foot certainly to the business valuation. And believe it or not, there are instances where purchase and sale agreement isn't really congruent with the business valuation. And so there's rework and there's at some points difficult discussions. I'm sure Gregory, you know, you guys, you know, do such a nice job start to finish with your sellers and buyers that I'm sure it doesn't happen in your line of work, but I've seen my fair share. So it's a pivotal part of the process, the allocation of the purchase price. And so it's just an important factor, but, you know, we can accommodate either or.
Yeah, and it can end up having a pretty big impact on the net proceeds a seller gets to keep upon the sale of the business. So we've got a little case study on this, and I realize I've been going too long already, and we're getting short on time. So I'll just mention that if you want to see the case study or any of this content, just let us know, and we can get it to you. But I will make a couple more comments on the 453A because it has provided such a big impact for some of our clients. So that's, again, the installment sale with monetization loan. So if you sell any large asset, so again, real estate, business, the IRS provides options for deferring the capital gains tax, and this is one of those options, and that's where you invest the tax dollars while deferring the tax for up to 30 years, and it can be powerful when you look at the long-term impact of that. It's just too simple spreadsheeting of it. But here's a quick case study, I'll run through this fast, but it's a case study of an owner that sells their business for $5 million. If their tax allocation had them at all capital gains versus ordinary income, their tax would be $1 million plus the net investment income tax of 3.8%, so it'd be a total of $1.19 million. They'd net $3.81 million after tax. That's good. That's pretty good. Definitely better than if they had paid ordinary income tax. So small win there, I would call it. But they would have to, if we looked at the code 453A, in that case, they'd have no capital gains on day one, no capital gains tax. They would have to pay an installment cost and lending an escrow fee of $325,000. That's the downside of it. There's a cost to it. So that's a lot of money. But it's way less. That money is then the tax. So in that scenario, the seller clears $4.675 million. They save $865,000. And it's, I don't know, that won't make or break anybody, but I feel like that's a ton of money. And there is some complexity to that strategy, but if you want to evaluate it or at least see if it's even an option in your situation, we're happy to have the conversation. And I'm going to transition into the tax avoidance strategies, and I'll apologize in advance because I'm going to go quick because I always commit to keeping these at 60 minutes or less, and I'm watching the timer here.
Aaron, but, can I toss one thing in really quick?
Yeah, for sure.
That if people are interested in that tax strategy, that our blog has a very robust library related to that. I know Jack Gruber has written articles on that for our blog, or a whole nother topic. Our blog today posted an article on 721 exchanges. So we have developed our blog as a library resource for the entrepreneurial community, and there's several hundred articles on everything related to buying and selling a business. And I encourage anyone to take a look and dig in as much as you want, but many of the topics covered today have supplemental materials also there.
Awesome. And it is. I'll definitely reinforce that comment with the encouragement to check out the blog. It's an amazing resource. And you guys get a ton of hits on that, don't you?
We do. And I think Wade has also written articles on financing for it, haven't you, Wade?
Yes, you're too kind. Yes.
So we just talked about a few ways, at least, to reduce or defer tax, and now part two of the tax playbook is techniques that can result in the avoidance of tax altogether, where you totally avoid it altogether. And there's quite a few techniques here. We don't get into all of them, But at least wanted to give you a sense of the scope of the options that you want to be aware of, that you want to make sure your team is looking at on your behalf. I've bolded a couple that we'll go a little deeper on. And these are all techniques that when we work with business owners, we evaluate them in the context of their financial plan. So first is a tax-free reorg or statutory merger, tax-free reorganization. And that's where one company is buying another. You can sometimes structure the sale as a tax-free merger. I've got a friend who owns a marketing company, and when they acquired a competitor, the seller didn't want to retire. They wanted to stay on board, and they just wanted to do it with less management responsibilities, and the seller didn't want all the cash up front. So they did a stock swap, and they traded their equity for shares of the buyer's company, and that allows the seller to participate in the growth of the larger firm and avoid tax along the way. Switching to an S corporation is another one, and there's generally just one tax to shareholders on either an asset or stock sale. And if you're looking at selling a business several years down the road, at least looking at whether switching to an S corporation now can be a helpful exercise. Again, you don't have to do this on your own, but you'd have your team do that. The team should be evaluating that. And again, we see that missed quite a bit. Section 1202, which we will get into on the next slide, so I'll skip that on this one, but capital gains bypass trusts. These are trusts that allow you to avoid paying tax when something you own is sold at a profit, like a business. And it also works for stocks. So if someone had Amazon or Microsoft stock or even an apartment building, that's gone up a lot. If they sell that asset, they pay tax on the gains. But like many parts of the tax code, there's a way to avoid it, and capital gains bypass trusts are one category. ESOPs, so we talked about those earlier. Tax shifting, this is one where we'll cover more in a minute, and I know we covered that already, but I'll share a couple other nuances to it that have been powerful for our clients and that have allowed them to avoid tax altogether, not just defer it. Qualified opportunity zones are important, and then strategic tax swapping, which allows, it's a way to invest a portfolio that allows you to bank tax losses and be able to bank those losses for future years when you have a large capital gain, so like a business sale. You can use them. We've had clients use those to avoid tax on a substantial portion of their business sale. I haven't even talked to you about this, Gregory. Have you guys dealt with Section 1202 much or at all?
We have not.
So that's that we end up doing a fair bit of that, and that's where under that section of the code, the gain of the sale of that type of stock, if it's held for 5 years, is partially or entirely excluded from income up to $10 million. And this is an old provision in the tax code, but it got forgotten for a while, but there were some somewhat recent tax code changes that sort of unearthed it, especially in the startup community. And most business owners in general should revisit it. And what's interesting about this is if you have a very valuable business, some tax experts believe the limit can be stacked. And we've actually implemented this with some clients where if you gift shares to a separate non-grantor irrevocable trust, that's a mouthful, but you can do that for the benefit of your kids or other family members, then each trust has its own $10 million gain exclusion. So we have someone we're working with now who is close to closing on a business sale that will give them close to $300 million, and they are setting up multiple of these trusts and getting close to $100 million of it 100% tax-free. And there's a bunch of criteria that goes into what would allow you to qualify for that section of the code, but it's like it's so worth a little bit of planning to see if you have the opportunity to qualify for that. I'm going to skip the tax shifting. This one's big. Tax holidays is important, and it does relate to tax shifting, which again is where, like Gregory mentioned, you can give stock to employees, or you can do it with kids or parents. And and tax holidays relate to that, where if you are in the lowest two tax brackets, so thinking of gifting money to and shifting shares or some of your money to family members that are in low tax brackets, if they're in the lowest two tax brackets, the capital gains tax rate goes down. And it actually goes down to 0%. A lot of people don't realize that. Meaning, if you're in the lowest two tax brackets, you can sell stock or a business at a 0% capital gains rate. Now, you can only get about $100,000 out of that if you're a married couple, the 0% capital gains rate. So it's you would not be able to go apply that to a multi-million dollar business sale. But if you're gifting to multiple family members, we have had clients do that, where they've given their kids some shares and another kid some shares and another kid some shares. And after all is said and done, they're avoiding tax. They're getting a 0% capital gains tax rate on it. And that's all I'll say about the tax holiday. But I'll, you know, as we kind of close down the tax discussion, the topic itself, we're finding more motivation from most people than normal, because we have this window of opportunity right now. And it's not just because year end is right upon us, but it's because tax rates are going up. Right now, taxes are historically low. They're not going to stay that way for much longer. Just you look at our debt, and that's, you know, the intent of this slide is to totally depress you, but this is a running ticker of our national debt. It's usdebtclock.org, and it live ticked up. And our debt in this country goes up about $100,000 a second. And this is the data as of our last workshop in November. And here it is now. It's up $122 billion in 25 days. So our U.S. total debt is $85 trillion. Anyway, I bring that up because debt is high. There's momentum to raise taxes. So there's even more motivation across a lot of business owners to do something. Now,
Aaron, I will throw in really quick. I know we're running out of time, but what I've been following, and Wade, you can comment quickly as well, is that let's flip to the other side as far as buyers for a minute. And the Fed is talking about 3 interest rate hikes in 2022. And the reason I thought of it was debt. Every interest rate hike is bad for the U.S. government.
Yep.
But it's also bad for buyers and sellers, because a buyer who needs to pay more for money may have less to pay for a business, and also their debt service goes up. And so,
right.
Wade, you might comment, there may be some urgency to buy businesses in the first half of the year next year, while the interest rates are low and lock in interest rates on a fixed basis, because they could be growing throughout the year.
Yep.
100%. Yeah. And, you know, it hasn't happened in a few years, but, you know, we'll always do a rate sensitivity analysis on cash flows and to see, you know, how much could this buyer afford if rates were to move up, you know, 300 basis points. And I'm sure I'll run into it where the deal breaks down, you know, and we say, oh, we can't do it because the risk of interest rates rising are pretty solid.
Yep, for sure. And the last thing I would share on this topic in general is something I share in almost every workshop, which is that while knowledge is power, and hopefully you've gained some knowledge in this session, taking action is the key. So as Picasso says, action is the foundational key to all success. We got to go take action, and it's uncomfortable to take action in a lot of cases, but that's my encouragement, is take at least one action item away. And here's a few that we came up with that we put into a checklist. And if you want this checklist, we can send it to you. But these are things that we have found when business owners do these things, they are happier, they have less regrets, they get more money, they pay less tax. And I won't read them all today, but the number one on here I would encourage is a planning session. Just do a planning session. We do a free consultation. We can do it joint with Gregory and Wade, and get all of us in a room talking about your situation, going down a checklist, and making sure if you've done some things within your succession plan already, awesome, but identifying, are there areas that haven't been looked at yet where there could be some value to add? So
I would add, when you're, there's no substitute for knowledge and experience, and surround yourself with a strong, experienced team. Whether you're picking a banker, a wealth advisor, or perhaps a business broker, I would never hire someone who doesn't have at least a decade of experience. You got to start, draw a line at some point in your assessment, and people who haven't seen it, seen different turns. I know I was selling businesses in the last recession, 2009 to 2011. Knowledge and skills I learned through that experience helped me navigate COVID. So don't underestimate the value of experience and knowledge in who you consult with.
Yeah, and resources. So let us know if you want some resources. We've got those checklists. We've got some quick reference guides that have some of the basics for business owners inventoried into 1- and 2-sheet summaries, some of the basic tax items that a lot of business owners will find helpful, because it can get complicated. So to have some simple summaries we find is helpful. And thank you for joining. This is such an important topic. Your business could be your most valuable asset. We want to help you maximize it. The profits, the money you get from a sale, the tax benefits, all of it. And we're really good at doing that. And we'd love to talk, so reach out. We can set some time to discuss and at a very minimum, go through the checklist and see which items would give you the biggest lift. And a big plug for Gregory, because I've worked with him for a while. It can be such an important piece of your plan. That's a differentiator for them in the way they help businesses sell or owners sell their business, is they get paid on success, and success is measured by the ultimate sales price, versus a lot of brokerages that will charge a consulting fee, sometimes of several thousands of dollars a month, regardless of whether they get you a positive outcome or not. And that's one of my core beliefs, is aligning compensation to success and results is important. All of which, those things impact bottom line and they impact results and an eventual succession. So thank you, Wade and Gregory. You guys are really good at what you do. You add a lot of value to business owners, and thank you for sharing so willingly your intellectual capital. I know it's valuable, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thanks, Aaron. My pleasure.
Happy holidays, guys.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks.